Chapter 13. Enter the Hero. And so the unknown man shook his finger at Ivan and whispered, "Shh." Ivan lowered his legs from the bed and peered into the darkness. A man of about 38 years of age was peeking in cautiously from the balcony. Clean-shaven, dark-haired, sharp-nosed, with troubled eyes, and a curl of hair hanging down on his forehead. After making sure that Ivan was alone and listening intently, the mysterious visitor gained confidence and stepped into the room. Here Ivan saw that the new arrival was dressed in hospital garb. He was wearing underclothes, slippers on his bare feet, and a brown robe thrown over his shoulders. The visitor winked at Ivan, replaced a bunch of keys in his pocket, and inquired in a whisper, "May I sit?" Receiving an affirmative nod, he settled in a chair. "How did you get here?" Ivan asked in a whisper, obeying the dry finger. "Aren't the balcony gratings locked?"
"The gratings are locked," the guest confirmed. "However, Praskovya Fyodorovna is a very sweet but, alas, absent-minded person. I stole a bunch of keys from her a month ago and thus gained the ability to go out on the common balcony, which stretches around the entire floor. Thus, I can visit a neighbour every now and then."
"If you can get out on the balcony, you can take off. Or is it too high?" Ivan wondered.
"No," the guest replied firmly. "I cannot take off. Not because it's too high, but because I have nowhere to take off to." And after a pause, he added, "So, here we are."
"Here we are,"
Ivan replied, looking into the visitor's very anxious brown eyes. "Oh, yes," the guest grew worried all of a sudden. "You're not a violent one, I hope, because, you know, I just can't stand noise, commotion, violence, things like that. I despise human cries in particular, be they cries of suffering, rage, or any other kind. Reassure me. Tell me you're not violent."
"Yesterday, in a restaurant, I walloped this one guy in the mug," the transformed poet admitted bravely.
"Cause?" the guest asked sternly.
"Well, to tell you the truth, without any real cause,"
Ivan replied, embarrassed. "Disgraceful," the guest rebuked Ivan and added, "besides, what's with these expressions? Walloped in the mug? You can't say for sure whether a person possesses a mug or a face, and it's probably a face, so using your fists, you know. No, you just drop this stuff once and for all." Having reprimanded Ivan in this fashion, the guest inquired, "Occupation?"
"Poet," Ivan said reluctantly. The visitor became upset. "Oh, lousy luck," he exclaimed, but caught himself immediately, apologized, and asked,
"And what's your name?"
"Homeless."
"Oh. Oh," the guest said, cringing.
"So you don't like my poems?" Ivan asked with curiosity.
"I dislike them terribly."
"And which ones have you read?"
"I haven't read any of your poems," the visitor exclaimed nervously.
"So how can you say that?"
"Well, so what?" the guest replied. "As if I haven't read others. Then again, is this a miracle?"
"Very well, I'm prepared to take your word for it. Tell me yourself, are your poems any good?" "They're monstrous," Ivan said all of a sudden with brave sincerity. "Don't write any more," the guest beseeched him. "I promise and swear," Ivan said solemnly. They sealed the oath with a handshake, and then light footsteps and voices came from the corridor. "Shh," the guest whispered, and jumped out onto the balcony, closing the grating behind him. Praskovya Fyodorovna looked inside, asked Ivan how he felt, and whether he wished to sleep in the dark or in the light. Ivan requested that the light be left on, and Praskovya Fyodorovna left after wishing the patient a good night.
and when everything quieted down, the guest returned. In a whisper, he relayed to Ivan that a new patient had just been delivered to room 119, some fat, purple-faced man who kept carrying on about foreign currency in the ventilation shafts and swearing that evil spirits had taken residence in his place on Sadovaya. Curses Pushkin for all he's worth and keeps screaming, "Kurul Yesov, encore, encore," the guest narrated, twitching nervously. Calming down, he sat and spoke. Anyway, God be with him, and continued his conversation with Ivan. "So why exactly did you end up here?"
"Because of Pontius Pilate,"
Ivan replied, frowning at the floor.
"What?" the guest cried, forgetting all caution, and clamped his own mouth with his hand.
"An amazing coincidence. I beg you, do tell."
Feeling a strange sense of trust in the unknown man, Ivan began narrating yesterday's events at Patriarch's Ponds, hesitantly and timidly at first, and then with increasing confidence. Truly, Ivan Nikolaevich had acquired a grateful listener in the person of the mysterious key thief. The guest did not make him out to be a madman, took the greatest interest in the story, and became absolutely delighted as it progressed. Again and again he would interrupt Ivan with exclamations.
"Well, well, go on, I beg you. Only please, in the name of all that's holy, don't leave anything out."
Ivan did not leave anything out, for that made his storytelling easier, and gradually got to the part where Pontius Pilate stepped onto the balcony, wearing a white cape with blood-red lining. Here the guest clasped his hands as if in prayer and whispered,
"Oh, how I knew it! How I had guessed it all!"
The guest followed up the description of Berlioz's horrific death with a puzzling comment, his eyes flashing with malice. "The one thing I regret is that the critic Latunsky or the writer Mstislav Lavrovitch could not have been in this Berlioz's place." And he cried ecstatically but noiselessly,
"Go on!"
The guest was extremely amused at the cat, who tried to pay the conductress, and shook with silent laughter as Ivan, excited at the success of his story, crouched and hopped about quietly, imitating the cat with a coin near his whiskers.
"And so,"
Ivan concluded, growing sad and gloomy after relating the episode at Griboyedov,
"I ended up here."
The guest placed his hand sympathetically on the poor poet's shoulder and spoke thus,
"Unfortunate poet, but you have only yourself to blame, dear boy. You can't be so casual and even insolent around him, so now you're paying the price, and you really ought to be thankful you got off rather cheaply."
"So who is he already?"
Ivan asked, shaking his fists in excitement. The guest peered at Ivan and answered with a question.
"Now, you won't become agitated, will you? None of us are exactly reliable folk around here. No calling the doctor, no shots, none of that nonsense."
"No, no," Ivan exclaimed. "Tell me, who is he?"
"Very well," the guest replied, and enunciated authoritatively. "Yesterday, at Patriarch's Ponds, you met Satan." Ivan stuck to his promise and did not become agitated, but was nonetheless greatly flabbergasted.
"It couldn't be. He does not exist."
"Please, you of all people are one to talk. You were one of the first, it seems, who suffered by his hand. Here you are, as you can see, sitting in a psychiatric ward and still talking of how he doesn't exist. It's strange, frankly." Confused, Ivan fell silent. "From the moment you began to describe him," the guest continued, "I started to suspect just who it was you'd had the pleasure of chatting with yesterday. And really, I am surprised at Berlioz. Now you, of course, are a literary virgin." Here the guest apologised again. "But he, as far as I've heard, had at least read a few things." The very first words of this so-called professor scattered all my doubts.
"He's impossible to miss, my friend."
"Then again, you, please excuse me again, but unless I'm mistaken, you're a rather ignorant man, aren't you?"
Indubitably.
An unrecognizable Ivan agreed. So then, even the face that you described, different eyes and eyebrows. Pardon me, but perhaps you haven't even heard the opera Faust. Ivan grew frightfully embarrassed for some reason, and, with face aflame, began to prattle on about some trip to a Yalta resort. Right, right, unsurprising.
But Berlioz, I say again, astounds me. A man not only well-read, but evidently quite shrewd.
Though I must say in his defence that, naturally, Volant can pull the wool over a shrewder man's eyes.
What?
Ivan cried in turn.
Quiet!
Ivan gave himself a mighty smack on the forehead and rasped,
I get it! I get it! He had a W on his card! Aye, 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 now that's something!
In baffled silence, he stared at the moon floating beyond the window grating and then said,
So then, he really could have been at Pontius Pilate's. He had already been born then, hadn't he? And they call me crazy,
he added, pointing at the door indignantly. A bitter frown appeared around the guest's lips. Let's look truth in the face. The guest turned his head towards the nocturnal orb as it dashed through a cloud.
You and I are both insane. Why protest? You see, he had shaken you badly, and you went mad, for you evidently possess the prerequisites for that sort of thing. But that which you speak of undoubtedly did take place. Of course, it is so incredible that even Stravinsky, a brilliant psychiatrist, naturally failed to believe you. He examined you?
Ivan nodded.
Your companion has been at Pilate's. He's breakfasted with Kant.
And now he has paid a visit to Moscow.
But he's going to stir up hell knows what around here. Shouldn't he be caught somehow?
Ivan's old, not quite beaten self reared its head unsurely within the new Ivan.
You already tried, so that's enough for you,
the guest replied sardonically. I wouldn't recommend it to anyone else either.
As for stirring things up, you can bet on it.
Oh,
but what a pity that it was you who met him and not I.
Though all has burned and the coals are covered with ash, I swear I'd give Praskovya Fyodorovna's bundle of keys for such a meeting, for I have nothing else to give. I am destitute.
What do you want with him?
The guest moped and twitched for quite some time, but finally began. You see, strange as it is, I am here because of Pontius Pilate, just as yourself. Here, the guest looked round fearfully and said,
The thing is, a year ago I wrote a novel about Pilate. You're a writer?
The poet asked, intrigued. The guest glowered, shook his fist at Ivan, and then said, I am a master. He grew serious and extracted an extremely grimy black cap from the pocket of his robe, with an M stenciled on it in yellow silk. Putting it on, he showed himself to Ivan from the front and from the side to prove that he was indeed a master.
She sewed it for me with her own two hands,
he added mysteriously.
And what is your name?
I no longer have a name, the strange guest replied with dark contempt. I have renounced it, just as everything else in life. Let us forget about it.
Then at least tell me about your novel,
Ivan asked tactfully. Be my guest. My story is indeed rather unusual, the guest began. A historian by vocation, he had but 2 years ago worked in one of Moscow's museums and took up translations in his spare time.
From what language?
Ivan asked with interest.
I know 5 languages beside my native tongue,
the guest replied.
English, French, German, Latin, and Greek.
Well, I also read a little in Italian.
Well,
Ivan whispered enviously. The historian lived alone, having no relatives anywhere and few friends in Moscow. And, believe it or not, one day he won 100,000 rubles.
Imagine my surprise
the guest in the black cap whispered, when I thrust my hand into the laundry bin and saw it. The number was the same as the one in the newspaper. They gave me the ticket at the museum, he clarified. Having won 100 grand, Ivan's mysterious guest did the following. Purchased books, left his room on Myasnitskaya. Oh, that damn hole, the guest growled. And rented a place from a private builder in an alley near the Arbat. You know who these builders are? The guest asked Ivan and immediately explained. They're a small group of crooks who have somehow managed to survive in Moscow. He rented 2 rooms from a builder in the basement of a small house with a garden. He abandoned his job at the museum and began writing a novel about Pontius Pilate. Ah, that was the golden age, the narrator whispered, his eyes gleaming. A completely separate apartment with a hall and a sink with running water, he noted especially proudly. Tiny windows just above the path that led from the gate. In front of them, 4 steps away, by the fence, lilac, linden, and maple. Oh, oh, oh. Come winter, very rarely would I see someone's black boots in my window and hear the snow crunch beneath them. A flame burned always in my furnace. Suddenly, spring came, and I could see the lilac bushes through the blurry windows, bare at first, and then dressed in green. And it was then, during this past spring, that something infinitely more wonderful than winning 100 grand happened, which you'll agree is an enormous sum of money.
That's true,
a carefully listening Ivan concurred. I opened the tiny windows and sat in the other really tiny room. The guest began measuring space with his hands. Like so. Here's the couch, opposite it another couch, a small table in between, with a wonderful lamp on it. Books near the window, and here, a little desk. And in the first room, gigantic room, 150 square feet, books, more books, and the fireplace. Oh, what a place I had. The scent of the lilacs was incredible. And my head grew light with fatigue, and Pilate flew towards the ending.
White cape, red lining, understood,
Ivan exclaimed. Exactly. Pilate flew towards the ending, and I already knew that the last words in the novel would be, the 5th procurator of Judea, the knight Pontius Pilate. Well, naturally, I would go out for walks. 100 grand is an enormous sum, and I had an excellent grey suit. Or I would eat at some cheap restaurant. There was a wonderful place on the Arbat. Don't know if it's still there. Then the guest's eyes opened wide, and he continued to whisper, gazing at the moon. She carried these revolting, disturbing yellow flowers in her hands. Hell knows what they are called, but they're always the first to pop up in Moscow for some reason. And these flowers stood out very clearly against her black spring coat. She carried yellow flowers, an unpleasant colour. She turned into an alley off Tverskaya, and then she looked back. You know Tverskaya, right? Thousands of people were walking on Tverskaya, but I swear to you that she saw me alone, and she'd looked at me in this somewhat disturbed, almost sickly way. And I was stunned, not so much by her beauty, as by the extraordinary, unheard-of loneliness in her eyes. Obeying her yellow sign, I also turned into the alley and followed in her tracks. We traversed the crooked, boring alley silently, I on one side and she on the other. And imagine, there wasn't a soul there. I was tormented because I thought I had to say something to her and feared that I wouldn't be able to say a word, that she would leave and I would never see her again. And believe it or not, she suddenly spoke. Do you like my flowers? I clearly remember the sound of her voice, somewhat low but torn, and, silly as it may be, I thought I heard an echo carry through the alley and bounce off the dirty yellow walls. I crossed quickly to her side, approached and said, "No." She looked at me in surprise, and I came to the sudden and completely unexpected realization that all my life I had been in love with this exact woman. Isn't that something, eh? You'll call me crazy, of course.
"Nothing of the sort," Ivan exclaimed, and added, "I beg you, go on."
And the guest continued, "Yes." She looked at me in surprise, and then, after looking, she asked, "You don't like flowers at all?" I thought I detected hostility in her voice. I was walking beside her, trying to fall in step, and, to my surprise, I did not feel the least bit uncomfortable. "No, I like flowers, but not these," I said.
"Which ones?"
"I like roses." Then I regretted saying it, for she smiled apologetically and threw her flowers in a ditch. Somewhat at a loss, I picked them up and handed them to her, but she pushed them away, smiling, and I carried them myself. We walked silently for a little while until she took the flowers from my hands, threw them on the pavement, threaded her hand in a cuffed black glove through my arm, and we walked side by side.
"Go on," said Ivan, "and please don't skip anything."
"Go on?" the guest asked. Well, you could have guessed yourself what happened next. He wiped off an unexpected tear with his right sleeve and continued. Love leapt at us like an assassin in a dark alley and struck us both at once. So strikes lightning, so strikes a flick knife. Of course, she would later insist that it was not so, that we had loved each other since time untold, not knowing each other, never seeing each other, while she lived with another man and I with that... what's her face?
"With whom?"
Homeless asked. "With that, well, with that, the guest replied, snapping his fingers.
"You were married?"
"Well, yeah, that's why I'm snapping. To that, Veryonka? Manechka? No, Veryonka. That striped dress. The museum? I don't really remember." So then, she would say that she went out that day carrying yellow flowers so that I would find her at last, and had that not happened, she would have poisoned herself, for her life was empty. Yes, love struck us instantly. I knew this an hour later on the very same day, when, barely noticing the city around us, we found ourselves at the Kremlin wall by the riverbank. We spoke as if we had parted yesterday, as if we had known each other for many years. The next day, we planned to meet at the same spot on the Moscow River, and meet we did. The May sun shone down on us, and soon, very soon, this woman became my secret wife. She came to me every day, and I would wait for her right from the morning. My waiting consisted of rearranging the things on the table. 10 minutes in advance, I would sit by the window and listen for the sound of the tattered gate. And here's the funny thing. Before I met her, few people would come to our garden. In fact, pretty much no one came. And now it seemed to me as if the entire city suddenly headed there. Bang went the gate, bang went my heart. And imagine, it just had to be someone's filthy boots sticking in my face outside the window. A knife grinder. Who needed a knife grinder in our house? To grind what? What knives? She entered the gate but once, but my heart would palpitate at least 10 times before. I lie not. And when her hour came, and the clock hands pointed to noon, it would not stop pounding until, without tapping, almost silently, her shoes appeared in the window, adorned with black suede bows, clamped with steel buckles. Sometimes she would feel playful and, pausing by the second window, tap on the glass with the toe of her shoe. I would appear by that window in an instant, but the shoe would already be gone. The black silk obscuring the light would be gone. I had to go and open the door. No one knew of our liaison. I vouch for it. even though that sort of thing never happens. Her husband didn't know, nor did her friends. The people in the old house where I had my basement could certainly see that some woman came to visit me, but they did not know her name.
And who was she?
Ivan asked, supremely fascinated by the love story. The guest made a gesture, signifying that he would never tell that to anyone, and continued his tale. Ivan learned that the master and the unknown woman fell in love so deeply that they became completely inseparable. Already, Ivan could clearly visualize the two rooms in the basement of the house, sunk in perpetual twilight by the lilac bushes and the fence. The worn red furniture, the bureau with a clock on it that rang every half hour, and books. Books stretching from the painted floor to the sooty ceiling and the furnace. Ivan found out that from the first days of their relationship, the guest and his secret wife had come to the conclusion that it was fate itself that pushed them together at the corner of Tvetskaya and the alley, and that they were made for each other for all eternity. From the guest's tale, Ivan found out how the lovers spent their days. She would arrive, put on an apron immediately, and light a paraffin stove on a wooden table in the narrow hall, next to the sink that the unfortunate patient was so strangely proud of. She would cook breakfast and serve it on the oval table in the first room. During the thunderstorms in May, when water would roll noisily into the gateway outside the blurry windows, threatening to flood their last refuge, the lovers would heat up the furnace and bake potatoes in it. The potatoes gushed steam. Blackened potato skins left soot on their fingers. Laughter came from the basement as trees outside shed broken twigs and white shoots after the rain. When the storms passed and the humid summer came, the vase filled with roses, long awaited and beloved by both. He who called himself the master would work, while she would sit and read over what he had written, her thin fingers with sharply filed nails buried in her hair. When she was done reading, she would sew that little cap. Sometimes she would squat by the bottom bookshelves, or stand on a chair by the top ones and wipe the hundreds of dusty spines with a cloth. She foresaw fame. She spurred him on. And it was then that she started calling him a master. She waited for the promised final words about the fifth procurator of Judea, repeating loudly and in sing-song the phrases she especially liked, and said that her whole life was in this novel. It was finished in the month of August and given to some unknown typist who produced 5 copies of it. And finally, the hour came when they had to abandon their secret sanctuary and step out into life. And I stepped out into life, holding it in my hands. And then my life ended, the master whispered, and hung his head, and the sad black cap with the yellow M swayed in the air for a long time. He continued his tale, but it became somewhat incoherent. One could only understand that some sort of catastrophe had befallen Ivan's guest. For the first time, I found myself in the world of literature. Now, when it is all over and my ruin is evident, I recall it with horror, the master whispered solemnly and raised his hand. Yes, he shocked me considerably. Oh, how he shocked me. Who? Ivan whispered barely audibly, afraid to interrupt the upset narrator. Why, the editor. I'm telling you, the editor. Yes, so he read it. He stared at me as if I had a swollen abscess in my cheek. He looked sidelong into the corner of the room and even sniggered in embarrassment. He crumpled the manuscript unnecessarily and grunted. The questions he asked sounded insane to me. Saying nothing of the contents of the novel, he asked me who I was and where I had come from, how long I had been writing, and why no one had heard of me before. He even asked, from my point of view, a truly idiotic question. Who had given me the idea of writing a novel on such an odd subject? Finally, I grew tired of him and asked him straight out whether he would publish the novel or not. Here he began to fuss and mumble, and declared that he could not make this decision by himself, that other members of the editorial board would have to become acquainted with my work, namely the critics Latunsky and Ahriman, and the writer, Mstislav Lavrovitch. He asked me to come back in 2 weeks. I returned in 2 weeks, and was greeted by some girl whose eyes were practically crossed at her nose from constant lying.
"That's Lapshenikova, the editorial secretary," sneered Ivan, who was well acquainted with the world so angrily described by his guest. "Perhaps," the other cut him off. "Anyhow, it was from her that I received my novel, at this point considerably grimy and tousled. Trying not to look me in the eyes, Lapshenikova informed me that the publishing house had enough material for 2 years ahead, and therefore the question of publishing my novel was, as she put it, not pertinent. "What else do I remember after this?" the master muttered, rubbing his temple. "Yes, the fallen flower petals on the title page, and my lady friend's eyes. Yes, I remember those eyes." The guest's tale became even more jumbled, even more riddled with gaps. He spoke of slanted rain and despair in his basement sanctuary, of how he tried other places. In a whisper, he exclaimed that he did not blame her who pushed him into battle, did not blame her at all. Oh, no, not at all. I remember, how I remember that accursed insert in the paper, the guest muttered, describing a newspaper sheet in the air with two fingers. And Ivan guessed from the subsequent jumbled phrases that some other editor had printed a large excerpt of the novel, written by the one who called himself the master. According to him, it was not 2 days before a different paper carried an article by the critic Ahriman, titled "Enemy Under an Editor's Wing." The article proclaimed that Ivan's guest had abused the editor's carelessness and ignorance and attempted to drag an apologia for Jesus Christ into print.
"Yes, I remember, Ivan exclaimed, "but I forgot your name."
"Let us leave my name alone, I repeat. It is no more," the guest replied. "My name is not the point." A day later, an article signed by Mstislav Lavrovitch appeared in another paper. In it, the author suggested striking, and striking hard, at pilotism, and the icon dauber who plotted to drag it, again that accursed word, into print. Dumbfounded by this term, pilotism, I opened a third paper. Here were two articles, one by Latunsky, and another sign with the letters N.A. Let me assure you that the handiwork of Ahriman and Lavrovitch could be considered a joke next to what Latunsky had written. Suffice it to say that Latunsky's article was entitled "A Belligerent Old Believer." I was so engrossed in reading the article about myself that I did not notice how she, I forgot to close the door, appeared before me. A wet umbrella and equally wet newspapers in her hands. Her eyes spat fire, and her cold hands were shaking. First she ran to kiss me, and then, banging her hand on the table, she said in a hoarse voice that she would poison Latunsky. Ivan grunted in embarrassment, but did not say anything. Utterly joyless days set in. The novel was finished. There was nothing left to do, and our lives were spent sitting on the rug next to the furnace and staring into the fire. We now spent more time apart than before, though. She would go out for walks. As for me, I had a peculiar moment, as it often happened in my life. I suddenly acquired a friend. Yes, imagine that. I'm generally not inclined to become close to people. I'm hellishly odd in that way. I approach people stiffly, distrustfully, suspiciously. And imagine, despite all that, someone unforeseen and unexpected always manages to sneak up on me. Someone who looks like hell knows what, and still I happen to like him best of all. And so, it was at that accursed time that the gate of our little garden opened. I remember, it was a really nice autumn day. She was not home, and a man came through the gate, entered the house on some business with my landlord, and then walked down to the garden and quickly became acquainted with me somehow. He introduced himself as a journalist. I liked him so much, would you imagine, that to this day I sometimes remember him and miss him. Later on, he began to drop by my place. I discovered that he was a bachelor, that he lived nearby in a similar apartment, but found it cramped and so on. He never really invited me to his place. My wife did not like him in the least, but I defended him. She said, "Do as you will, but I'm telling you that this man makes a truly repulsive impression on me." I laughed. Yes, but what did I find so appealing about him, really? The thing is that a man without some sort of surprise inside, in his closet, is generally uninteresting. This Aloysius... Oh yes, I forgot to mention that my new acquaintance was named Aloysius Margaritch, had such a surprise. Namely, never before had I met a man with a mind like Aloysius's, and I am sure I never will again. If I could not grasp the point of some remark in the paper, Aloysius could explain it to me literally in 1 minute, and moreover, it was evident that the explanation was a matter of course to him. It was the same with life's various events and questions. But that was not all. Aloysius conquered me with his passion for literature. He would not rest until he coaxed me into reading my entire novel to him from beginning to end. He spoke of the novel very flatteringly, even while guessing all of the editor's remarks about it with remarkable accuracy, as if he had been there. He was spot on. What's more, he explained to me with the utmost clarity why my novel could never be published, and I saw that his analysis was flawless. He spoke directly. Such and such a chapter was a no-go. The newspaper articles did not stop. I laughed at the first few, but the more they appeared, the more my attitude towards them changed. The second stage was one of surprise. I felt something incredibly false and insecure in literally every line of these articles, despite their menacing and confident tone. It seemed to me, and I could not get past it, that the authors of these articles were not saying what they wanted to say, and that their rage stemmed from that very fact. And then, would you imagine, came a third stage. Fear. Not fear of the articles, mind you, but fear of other things completely unrelated to them or the novel. Thus, for example, I began to fear the dark. In short, it was the stage of mental illness. No sooner did I extinguish the lamp in my tiny room than I began to imagine some sort of giant squid with very long and cold tentacles crawling in through the small window, even though it was closed, and I had to sleep with the light on. My beloved changed significantly. I told her nothing of the squid, of course, but she could see that there was something wrong with me. She grew thin and pale, stopped laughing, and kept begging my forgiveness for her advice to publish the excerpt. She told me to drop everything and go south to the Black Sea to spend the remainder of my 100 grand on that trip. She was very insistent, and so as not to argue, something told me I would not be going to the Black Sea, I promised her to do so in a few days. But she said that she would buy me the ticket herself. Then I took out all of my money, or about 10,000 rubles, and gave it to her. "Why so much?" she asked, surprised. I said something about fearing thieves, and asked her to hold on to my money until my departure. She took it and placed it in her purse. She began to kiss me and said it would be easier for her to die than to leave me alone in this condition, but that she was expected and must submit to inevitability, that she would come tomorrow. She begged me not to be afraid of anything. This was at dusk in mid-October. She left. I lay down on the couch and fell asleep without lighting the lamp. I awoke from the sensation that the squid was back. Groping about in the dark, I barely managed to turn on the light. My pocket watch showed 2 o'clock in the morning. I went to bed on the verge of illness and woke up ill. It suddenly seemed that the autumn darkness would pop the window pane and flood the room, and I would drown in it like in ink. I stood up, no longer a man in control of himself. I cried out and felt the urge to run to someone, if only to my landlord upstairs. I fought with myself like a madman. I found enough strength to reach the furnace and light some firewood. When the logs began to crackle and I heard the clattering of the furnace door, I felt slightly better. I dashed to the hall and put on the light there. I found a bottle of white wine, opened it, and began to drink straight from the bottle. This dulled my fear slightly, enough at least that I did not go running to the landlord, but instead returned to the furnace. I opened the door so that the fire scalded my face and hands, and whispered, "Sense that I am in trouble. Come, come, come." But no one came. The fire roared in the furnace. The rain slashed at the windows. Then came the last drop. I took the heavy manuscripts and draft notebooks of the novel out of my desk drawer and began to burn them. This was horribly tough to do because used paper burns poorly. Breaking my fingernails, I tore apart the notebooks, sticking them vertically between the logs and ruffling the pages with the poker. The ash got the better of me at times, smothering the flame, but I fought it, and the novel, stubbornly resisting, was nonetheless doomed. Familiar words flashed in front of me. Amber climbed relentlessly up the pages, but the words still stood out. They vanished only when the paper turned black, and I beat them down furiously with the poker. Just then, someone clawed at the window quietly. My heart jumped, and placing the final pad into the flames, I rushed to open the door. Brick steps led up from the basement to the outer door. Stumbling, I ran up to it and asked quietly, "Who is it?" And a voice, her voice, answered, "Me." I do not remember how, but I got past the chain and the key. The moment she stepped inside, she clung to me, all wet, with wet cheeks and tousled hair, shaking. I could only pronounce a single word. "You. You." And my voice broke, and we ran downstairs. She got out of her coat in the hall, and we quickly entered the first room. With a quiet cry, she reached into the furnace with her bare hands and threw out onto the floor the last of what remained there, a sheaf that had caught fire on the bottom. Smoke instantly filled the room. I stamped out the flame with my feet while she sank onto the couch and began to cry wildly and feverishly. When she quieted down, I spoke. "I have come to hate this novel, and I am afraid. I am sick. I am scared." She stood up and said, "God, how sick you are. Why this? Why? But I'll save you. I'll save you. Oh, what is happening?" I could see her eyes, swollen from the smoke and the tears. I could feel her cold hands stroking my forehead. "I'll heal you. I'll heal you," she muttered, digging into my shoulders. "You'll restore it. Why? Why didn't I keep a single copy?" She bared her teeth in fury and said something unintelligible. Then, compressing her lips, she began to gather up and straighten out the burned pages. It was some chapter from the middle of the novel. I don't remember which. She bundled up the burned sheets carefully, wrapped them in paper, and tied them with a ribbon. Her every action showed that she was full of determination and in control of herself. She demanded wine and, after a drink, spoke more calmly. "This is how one pays for lies," she spoke. "And I don't want to lie any more. I would stay here with you even now, but I don't want to do it this way. I don't want him to always remember that I ran away from him at night. He never did me any wrong. He was called away suddenly. There was a fire at the factory where he works. But he'll be back soon. I will have a talk with him tomorrow morning, tell him I love another, and return to you forever. But tell me, perhaps you do not want this." "My poor, poor darling," I said to her, "I won't allow you to do this. Bad things will happen to me, and I don't want you to perish with me." "Is that the only reason?" she asked, bringing her eyes close to mine. "The only one." She livened up immensely, clung to me, hugging my neck, and said, "I perish with you. In the morning I shall be here." And this is the last I remember of my life. A band of light coming from my hall, and in it a dishevelled lock of hair, her beret, and her resolute eyes. Also the black silhouette of the outer door and the white package. I would walk you back, but I haven't the strength to return on my own. I am afraid.
"Don't be. Wait a few hours. Tomorrow morning I'll be with you."
Those were her last words in my life.
"Shh!"
The sick man interrupted himself suddenly and raised his finger.
"Quite the restless moonlit night, this is."
He vanished on the balcony. Ivan heard little wheels roll by in the corridor, and someone whimpered or yelped quietly. When everything was quiet again, the guest returned and revealed that room 120 had received a new occupant. Someone asking for his head back was brought in. The two spent a moment in silent alarm, but then calmed down and returned to the interrupted conversation. The guest barely opened his mouth, but the night was truly a restless one. Voices still came from the corridor, and the guest began to speak in Ivan's ear so quietly that, apart from the first phrase, his tale belonged to the poet alone.
"A quarter hour after she left me, someone knocked on my window."
The sick man was clearly very distressed by whatever he was whispering in Ivan's ear. Spasms passed repeatedly over his face. Fear and rage flowed and darted in his eyes. With his hand, the narrator gestured somewhere in the direction of the moon, which had long since left the balcony. Only when all the outside sounds ceased did the guest move away from Ivan and speak louder. And so, in the middle of January, at night, in the same coat, but with the buttons torn off, I shivered in the cold of my tiny garden. Behind me lay heaps of snow, concealing the lilac bushes, while ahead and below were my own little windows, dimly lit and draped. I pressed against one of them and listened. A gramophone was playing in my rooms. That was all I heard, but I could not see a thing. After standing around a while, I went out the gate into the alley. Flurries frolicked there. A dog darted under my feet and frightened me, and I ran across the street away from it. Cold and fear, the latter now a constant companion, were driving me into a frenzy. I had nowhere to go, and the simplest solution would have been to throw myself under a tram on the street my alley led to. Far away I could see those icy boxes, full of light, and heard their repugnant screeching in the cold. But, my dear neighbour, the thing was that fear possessed every cell of my body, and I was afraid of the tram just as I was of the dog. Yes, you won't find an illness in this building worse than mine, I assure you.
But you could have let her know,
Ivan said, sympathising with the poor patient.
Besides, she had your money, didn't she? Surely she has kept it?
Have no doubt, of course she has. But evidently, you do not understand me. Or, more accurately, I have lost all powers of description I had once possessed. I do not miss them, though, for I no longer have any use for them. She... The guest looked reverently into the darkness of the night. She would be greeted with a notice from the madhouse. How can one send letters with an address such as this? Mentally ill? You must be joking, my friend. No, to make her unhappy, I cannot do that. Ivan had nothing to refute this, but he sympathized silently with the guest, commiserated with him, and the latter nodded his head and black cap from the pain of his memories, and spoke thus. Poor woman, though I have some hope that she's forgotten me.
But you may get better,
Ivan said timidly. I am incurable, the guest replied calmly. When Stravinsky says that he will restore me to life, I do not believe him. He is humane and simply wishes to console me. I do not deny, though, that I feel far better now. So where was I then? The cold, the trams flying by. I knew that this clinic had just opened and crossed the entire city on foot. Madness! Once outside of town, I would have probably frozen to death, but chance saved me. A truck had some sort of breakdown about 3 miles from city limits. I went up to the driver, and to my surprise, he took pity on me. The truck was headed here, and he drove me. I got off with frostbitten toes on my left foot, but they took care of that. And so here I am, for the 4th month now. And I don't find it bad here at all, you know. Truly, there is no need to make grand plans, dear neighbour. For instance, I once wanted to travel around the entire globe. Well, so it turns out it is not to be. I see but an insignificant portion of said globe. I doubt this is the best to be found on it, but I say again, it is not so bad. Summer approaches, and the ivy will wind round the balcony, just as Praskovya Fyodorovna promises. The keys have broadened my possibilities. The moon will come at night. Ah, but it is gone. The air is growing fresher. The night falls past midnight. It's time for me to go.
Tell me what happened afterwards with Yeshua and Pilate,
Ivan asked.
I beg you, I want to know.
Oh, no, no, the guest replied, twitching painfully. I cannot recall my novel without shaking. And your acquaintance from the Patriarchs could have done it better than I. Thank you for the conversation. Goodbye. And before Ivan could gather his wits, the grating closed with a quiet clang, and the guest disappeared.